Music and Booze with Mo is produced and distributed by the Center for Culinary Culture, home of the Cocktail Collection, and is available wherever fine podcasts can be heard. The Center for Culinary Culture, telling the story of food and drink, one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there's a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. I'm joined today by the master of mezcal and metal, Max Reese. He is here in LA. He can be found at Gracias Madre in West Hollywood. Go check it out online because it's got an amazing agave selection. And he's going to tell us all about the dirty and the good details of that industry. You're going to learn a lot today. He's also going to give you some tips on how to, do that Cookie Monster voice that those, like, hardcore metal dudes do without hurting yourself, kind of, sort of. And also, we'll talk about all the various reasons we're going to hell. So we talk a lot, so let's get into it.
All right, I turned on the recorder. We're recording. And it's all just audio. You don't have to worry about looking alert or anything like that.
Oh, okay. Thank God.
Yeah. Right? But yeah, I always like to start these things, just introduce yourself and where you're at, what you're up to, whatever, shit like that. So okay. You are?
No, my name is Max, Max Reese, full name Maxwell, but who has the time for that? I'm usually the beverage director at Gracias Madre in West Hollywood. I like cocktails a lot and I make a lot of them. And I also specialize in agave spirits, and more specifically, ethically sourced, high-quality agave spirits. And I'm a bit of an advocate on that forefront.
Which I love.
And thank you. I'm also a big fan that I get to do that and call that my job.
Yeah.
I feel very lucky and fortunate. A very gratifying aspect of a job that can normally be mundane to most people, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're really lucky that you have that opportunity to use your platform to teach people about, ethically sourced mezcal, mezcal and all that. Because as we know, there's not
lucky.
A lot of that out there in the world. Yeah. What sent you down the agave route?
It's kind of hard to put my finger on that because I've been asked that quite a few times, and I feel like I've gone back and I've listened to podcasts I've been on where I've been at that before, and I'm like, wow, I don't really have a set answer for this.
But, it just happened.
I'd say this is a good way to kind of tie it into music a little bit, is that I have always kind of loved to enjoy something that is a little off the beaten path, I'm a huge metalhead. I love to show someone a band and have them go, oh my God, I can't believe you listen to this every day, or this is so abrasive. And I'm like, no, it's an acquired taste. You know, it's musically magnificent. You just have to learn how to listen to it. And I honestly think maybe Mezcal kind of set me down that same path, because I was working behind the bar. I love Mezcal. I remember trying my first Mezcal and I remember going, oh my God, what is this? It's big. It's, you know, it's like something I've never tried. Most people would probably find this super abrasive. Mm-hmm. It's high in alcohol. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, this is out of a water bottle my buddy brought back from Oaxaca.
Right.
It wasn't the stuff that most people try first. It wasn't the, you know, with Guazana Rojo, you know, it was actually good Mezcal. Brought back by a bartender, and I remember going, this is great, I love it, and looking for it, and it wasn't really commercially available here in the United States yet, but as it became more and more available, I just was like, oh, there it is, I need it. And while working behind the bar, I was fortunate enough to work in programs that were very spirit-focused. I was working behind the bar at Republic, which was more eau de vie focused, and lots of cognacs, but they had a really beautiful, curated, you know, back bar. And I was just nerding out with my boss, Sean at the time, over agave spirits nonstop. And I was consulting at Gracias Madre. And once I kind of figured out, you know what, I'm an advocate for this. And I know a lot about it comparatively to most people, but I have the tools to become top of my field if I really put my head to it and know more than anyone else I know. Mm-hmm. So I just started, just basically anytime somebody was like, hey, do you want to sit down and have a conversation about my brand? Even if it was a brand I didn't like, I went, yes, that's absolutely what I want to do. And any books that come out, I would read. And anytime I had an opportunity to go to Mexico, I would go to Mexico. But I'd say that's the biggest, you know, it's just like once you start going down to Mexico and learning as much as you can intentionally about it, and not just going down on brand trips and going, oh, I'm going to get, you know, fucked up with these bartenders. And, you know, and you go down and you start trying to learn, you know, that's where I'd say you get the most. I'd say, so that was it for me. You know, it's just like, I'm obsessed with the beautiful culture, and it's nice to come in early because you actually have a say in kind of how people are going to perceive it moving forward. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, I've been an agave person. I grew up close to the border, right? So that was kind of like, awesome. I was in high school drinking Cuervo, which is terrible. But again, I was in high school. Right. But that kind of got me started. And also, like yourself, the first time I ever had Bacanora, it was not available in this country. And I had it because a family friend who's Mexican, had, you know, migrated years ago, went back to one of his properties there, came back with a bottle. You know, he had his own bottle that he had sealed up himself of Bacanora.
Great, yeah.
And he asked me if I wanted to try it. He's like, Mo, I know you like agaves. Do you want to try this? And this guy is a really good friend of my father's, right? So my dad's like, when did you start drinking this stuff, you know, to me? And I'm like, you just don't want to know those things, Dad.
But is he from Sonora?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he let me try some of it. And I was just like, whoa, this is like the best tasting gasoline ever. That was like the first thing that came to mind for me. And then he told me a story about how they actually did use... They used to use it as gasoline sometimes as well if they ran out in their Jeep. Pour that in there. It'll get us the last couple miles, you know?
Oh, wow.
And I just laughed. I don't think that's exactly what you're serving me, but I like the kind of legend behind it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it paints a picture.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of, my impression at the time was that, you know, Mezcal and Bacanora, all this stuff down there kind of made me think of like cachaça, aguardiente. You know, my family's South American. So it's the stuff that it's the moonshine of the country that you're speaking of, you know, and cachaça, I think it's well reported. There are thousands of cachaças there because they make them in each village and all this. And I know with mezcals, a lot of it originally, each village had their own mezcal. Yeah. You know, in the proper region.
I mean, for me, mezcal is, it's not even like as much of a village making something, it's everyone making it. I mean, it's, you'll go down to these villages in Michoacan and you'll go and yes, though you'll be visiting a producer that's renowned and everyone says that he makes the best mezcal in the village, but you'll go and they'll have these communal fermentation vats where, you know, during the season where they're all making mezcal, they all take turns making batches of mezcal in this, in these communal settings. And you come to realize that, like, yes, even though there is somebody that is obviously the most knowledgeable in town and he's renowned as being the family that does that the best, it's everyone makes it. You know, mezcal is typically made in someone's backyard for their family for, you know, celebrations and parties. And I mean, that's what it is. I grew up I'm Jewish, you know, I don't practice or anything, but like, you know, it's my culture is my, you know, my family does Passover and all that. Like, I think what's cool about a lot of mezcal is that you don't realize is that it's like, oh, hey, like, yeah, there's a quinceañera. I know that there's going to be in a few months and we're just going to make a ton of mezcal and my family is going to have a really fun party. And I think that that's what that is.
I mean, I think a lot of cultures have that sort of thing. You can refer to the Christmas tamale, which you probably weren't aware of. I mean, if you grew up in California, then you're kind of aware of it. If you grew up in in Hispanic places, you become aware of it. But if you're growing up in Michigan, you have no idea there's such a thing as a Christmas tamale, you know? Like, what does that mean? Tamale making parties. And I know my family's Colombian. The Colombian tamale is a much larger banana leaf version of a tamale. And whenever there was...
Catalina dropped off quite a few with me recently.
There you go. So if you... if there's ever a big event in a Colombian community, somebody is making a pile of those things for that event. You know, so I get what you're saying in terms of, I think there are lots of communities that do this, that get all together and will do something to prepare for something like that. So on your travels.
Jewish community just, you know, compares interest rates. That's all we do.
Well, maybe you stay thinner than some of us Colombians. there's a lot of meat and masa in our diet. when you're wandering, you must have stumbled into some really amazing just local mezcal that you can't get here that you feel so lucky to have had. Are you have any good stories about that sort of thing? Stumbling.
Oh man, I mean, always. So many, right? There's so many to try. And it's interesting because when for people that haven't been to Oaxaca,
I've never been. It's on my list.
Yeah, I mean it's a breathtaking experience, but I also think that one of the things that not a lot of people like realize is it's so much more special and relevant to the spirit when you try it where it's being made, you know. And I don't know. I've had these mezcals where I'll have this religious experience when I'm trying it at the Palenque. And then you try it again when you bring it home and it's still wonderful, but it's so different not being in the time and place where you're having it. Cause I mean, I've had these experiences. I think one thing people don't realize too is when there's these varying altitudes where you're trying it. So a lot of the time when you're trying something like Bacanora, things like that, or mezcals from Jalisco, a lot of the time those spirits, they have a very savory flavor versus ones you might have in certain areas of Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. And I think what's important to keep in mind is altitude. Because, you know, it's like when you're in an airplane, you crave savory, right? That's what people drink Bloody Marys. So when you're in a higher...
Yeah, I just never thought about that, but you're right.
I mean, I was in a cocktail competition that was in an airplane when we were flying to London Cocktail Weekend. Mm-hmm. I made all my cocktails savory because I knew that that is what your palate wants when you're at that altitude. So, a long time when I've been there and I've had these insane experiences, I'll come back and I'm like, you know what? It's like my palate has changed a little bit from when I initially tried this. So I just think there is something beautiful about just trying these people's spirits when you pull over the side of the road and you just try these. I mean, I've had experiences where it's these things you can't bring back. One of my favorites, are you familiar with the Mazonte lineup?
No, I don't think so. I have to see the label.
Mazonte is fantastic. Please come to the bar anytime you want to try it. my ear pod fell out and landed in my hair. Okay, there it is. So
we probably have about the same amount of hair too, so I understand. Yeah. Mine's just a little bit straighter than yours right now.
Right. I know, I got the curls, morning curls. So there's a gentleman by the name of Jorge Perez. Mm-hmm. Jorge Perez he distills out of northern Michoacán. Mazonte is the importer, by the way. We're not the importer, the curator.
Okay.
That brings it in. It's very high-end. A gentleman by the name of Pedro Jimenez, like the sherry, curates it. His shop is based out of Guadalajara. And I consider him more of a historical preservationist. So he goes and he finds these agave forms that typically aren't from Oaxaca. He has one bottle I've had from Oaxaca, which was a gift. He doesn't import it. But he finds these styles of mezcal that he's trying to preserve in predominantly Jalisco and a little bit of Michoacán. And he basically pays considerably higher than asking price, refuses to buy over half of a batch because he wants it to be intact with like the native culture that would enjoy it. He doesn't want to alter that. And he has some of my favorite, you know, it's not always the most approachable, but it is absolutely my favorite. Some of my favorite mezcal I've ever had.
Wow.
Just absolutely insane. But Jorge Perez out of Michoacan, he lives in a village that only makes Alto. And Alto is a kind of agave. It's one of the largest agaves I've ever seen get made into distillate. It also has one of the lowest Brix content by volume out of any agave. So giant plants, almost no yield. He does all of his distilling in these beautiful Filipino hybrid stills, which mean that they're basically wood and brick. And he does his, there's this holy tree where the monarch butterflies migrate to during from Canada. Mm-hmm. And he has this whole story about how he's praying in front of it and all this stuff, and he got struck by lightning and he turned the two halves of this tree into his stills. So it looks like these giant trees.
The tree was struck by lightning, or he was struck by lightning?
The tree.
The tree. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay. But he took the halves of this tree.
Turned it into his two stills.
Wow.
So they look like these two halves of this beautiful tree. And this is in that village, one of the villages I was telling you about, where they all have these communal fermentation vats, mm-hmm. but he's like the legendary one. His family is well known for making it. Mm-hmm. He is a total badass. Everyone respects him in the village. The rumor about him is that Jorge plays soccer with rocks. That's like, that's like how badass he is, you know? But anyway, so when you
that's awesome.
I know, it's so ridiculous. He's like a rock star.
Yeah, no, but, totally.
So when you go down to Michoacan, you can get his stuff under the exactly rock star. Right? You can get his mezcal underneath the label of Mezcalante. And when you go to a bar there, that you'll have Jorge Perez Mezcalante, and you can get it. So all he makes is Alto, but you can get Alto con clavo, con naranja. You know, so what he does is takes the distillate, he adds all these different fruits into the still for second mm-hmm. distillation. They're all great. His original is always my favorite. Super good.
Yeah.
But so I brought back some special bottles, and there were some of my favorites to stick around. So he also is notorious for doing some of the most experimental pechugas out of anyone I've seen. Oh, so okay. There's like they basically tell you, they're like, if you're an animal and you're wandering onto Jorge's property, you better watch out, because you're going to wind up in a pechuga.
He's gonna steam you.
Yeah, exactly. So he does something pretty interesting, which is not only does he do a more traditional sense where he'll hang the animal in the top of the still, mm-hmm. But he also does one where he'll hang him in the top of the still and then also take an additional animal of the same type, and he'll actually put it in a glass aging carboy and let it rest with the distillate for a period of time.
Oh wow!
Kinda like Chinese, like a lot of Chinese distillate.
Yeah.
So I brought back, which was really fun last time I was visiting him. I brought back one where he did that with rattlesnake. I have some amazing photos of it.
I knew you were going to say rattlesnake. I seriously, my head was like rattlesnake. I knew it.
It was pretty cool.
Super psychic moment right there. I should have written it down.
So much fun with it, which is I did one where he did it with coyote. Not Quixote. A lot of people were like, do you mean Quixote? The stock
agave.
I said, no, coyote. They're like, do you mean coyote? Like the type of agave. I was like, no, coyote. Like
you're like Wiley.
Yeah, Wiley Coyote. So it was really fun because I brought it back, and I brought back one where he just distilled it in the top of the still, and I brought back one where he also had it rested in the vessel. And that was my favorite because I just got to bring it around and, I'd bring it to Sunny's Hideaway on it.
Yeah.
Because I'd get up, or something like that. I got up 1:30 and bring it by and try the staff on it. And it was so much fun just to bring around. And it's just like, there's something really cool about just like people are like, oh, what'd you bring back from Mexico? And I'm like, oh, here's this thing. But it's even cooler when you're just like, here's this thing that's going to, you're going to remember and you're going to talk about for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Like, here's this insane bottle. And it was so much fun.
That is crazy. That is crazy.
It was great.
I have a question for you because you're at Gracias Madre. Yes.
The vegan question.
You're Gracias y Madre, which is an amazing vegan place. I was actually there maybe like 2 months ago. I don't think you were there that night. With a friend of mine. Because it's in West Hollywood, and in LA, if you don't live within a couple miles, I live on over by Pasadena. That could be like forever as a drive. But I'm like, I got to get here. And of course, it had an amazing agave. there's the agave menu. And I told my friend that I met there, I'm like, we're only drinking agaves. I don't even know if they offer anything else, but it really doesn't
matter. Yeah, we don't.
Okay, yeah, I'm like, that's what they do. That is their thing. That is what they do. I think I just spoiled myself with a Ray Campero, But the vegan question, it's an amazing vegan place. So can you get away with mezcals like that there? Do you not have them on the menu?
No, I can't. I don't do any pechugas. Well,
yeah.
I do technically. I don't do any traditional sense pechugas, which are...
Got it.
For people that don't know what a pechuga is, it translates to breast. Mm-hmm. But to the people of agave, it usually means more of heart. Mm-hmm. Usually what it is it's going to be the matriarch of the family. So the mom or the grandma who has kind of witnessed multiple generations of mezcaleros within her family. Mm-hmm. And usually what she'll do is she'll curate a selection of fruits and nuts of the season. And then usually an animal that is associated to the time of year on the property. Mm-hmm. And basically what it is it's the heart of the palenque. So it's a snapshot of a time and place. So even though it translates to breast literally, a lot of the time they do hang a chicken or turkey breast in the top of the still. Mm-hmm. To them, it more literally is just like fruits, nuts, animals. So it can be iguana, it can be turkey, it can be whole turkey, it can be turkey breast, it can be coyote, like we just talked about.
I never knew that. That's so amazing. Yeah. That's so amazing that there's this strong kind of matriarchal component.
Yes.
To that process, especially when you hear about places where like, maybe they not allowing women to be part of the process or to be the distiller or anything like that. And again, that makes me feel more of that kind of community bond.
There's a lot more of that coming to light. There's definitely, I'd say mezcal celebrates the women a lot more than a lot of other spirits I've seen. Mm-hmm. Not always on the bottle, but definitely behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see generations of people starting to celebrate it more. Places like Quiche, the band Quiche, like there's Rana Sanchez is a prolific mezcalera. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more of these mezcaleras that are coming to light and doing these things. There's this brand called Fane Canestini, which isn't currently imported to the United States, but if you swing by the bar, I have a few bottles. But that's an all-female mezcal collective.
Oh, wow.
Which is really cool.
Amazing.
Which is really neat. So if you swing by, I can taste you on that.
Yeah.
It's coming a lot more prevalent. So I went down and I made a pechuga at the Don Mateo family. Mm-hmm. With Emilio, who's the current mezcalero. And we did like a pechuga as a group. It was like me, Sean from Republic, Gino, who imports it, Dave OG from K&L Wine. It was great. Mike Rooney from Orange County over at Baca. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we got to do our own little blend. And that one in particular, it was turkey, iguana, venison.
Wow.
It was a lot. And rabbit. Fruits and nuts of the season, and we did the blend, and that was when it became very apparent to us like how much of a role that the mom had to play in it. His Emilio's mother, his father had just recently passed away, so it was like he's been taking over. Very special. It was very beautiful and sad. And when we were working on the packaging for it, when they started bringing it back, everyone agreed that it should be usually where there's a picture of Emilio or the father on the bottle. Mm-hmm. We put a picture of the mom. So because the pechuga, you'll notice from Don Mateo, will always have a picture of the mom on it now.
Oh, that's so cool. That is so cool. Well, since you have been really using your platform, I was saying, to educate people a lot, and you're mm-hmm. looking at like ethically done mezcals and all this stuff. Can you rattle off a couple that we can support? Here in the States, sometimes it's more of a quest to get some of these things. We live in California. Yeah. We could, in the traveling days, we could go to Mexico and maybe find these things out. But what can someone either order online or maybe at mm-hmm. their boutique liquor store, some places actually carrying stuff like that? What are some good ones people should look out for?
Yeah, I mean, there's also some good ones to look out for. Like I was bringing up Mazonte earlier. Yeah. The Mazonte ones are amazing, but they're probably at a price point that most people will find a little inaccessible. but if you see one, grab it. They're
How
great.
Do you spell that? Mazonte, is it M? What?
M-E-Z-O-N-T-E.
Okay, Mazonte. Just like it sounds. Okay. Making sure. Mazonte.
Yeah, which no, it's great. But yeah, I mean, I'd say for something accessible, especially here in California, one of my favorites, and I'm not just saying this because they're based out of LA and they've become friends of mine, but the Mall BN lineup. So there's an old saying, it's for all good things, mezcal, for all bad things, mezcal. that's where Mall BN comes from. It's a great name. Yeah, so those guys do a really good job of importing some of my favorite mezcals, but the reason I'm plugging them out is because you can get Mall BN Espadine, which is like their well mixing mezcal. And I still think it's a fantastic representation of the category. It's well priced. You can mix with it. You can sip it neat. It's an all around mezcal to be enjoyed, ethically produced, ethically imported. People are, you know, paid well. It's like complete traceability. And then they have a green tape lineup, which is their more of their wild varietals and more, you know, a boutique expressions. And those are also at an incredibly accessible price, which is great. So, I mean, those are all amazing. I think that Ben and Anthony, the two gentlemen curating it, have outstanding palettes for mezcal. And I think that each one is very unique and, like I said, well-priced.
Yeah.
And then they're also importing the Neta lineup as well as the La Locura lineup, which are some of my favorite higher-end sipping mezcals. And those are all underneath their import portfolio. So I think they're doing a great job. And those are honestly some of my favorite bottles. I have like, it's like kind of like one of those things where you know, it's like I'm such a fan of their work, and then you end up knowing them and you're like, oh, I guess you're my friends now. You know?
It's one of those,
but their stuff is great.
Yeah. You never know if you want to meet your idols, you know, it doesn't always work out.
No, I love that stuff. Yeah, right. It worked out this time. But, yeah. I mean, their stuff is so good. Neta Espadine, has become a bottle I just always have at home. It's one of my favorite bottles in mezcal I've
Neta?
Ever had. Neta, yes. Yeah, Neta is really cool. It's slang, Mexican slang. It means the truth or legit, or like the real deal. So if you were like, oh man, Neta, it means like, oh yeah, that's legit. That's the real deal. That's the truth, right? So cool. Neta is one of my favorite curators within their curating. NETA. I highly recommend their stuff. It's not cheap, but it's worth every
time. Totally worth it.
It is. So good.
What is
also Cinco Sentidos is another one of my favorite high ends that have been being imported.
Cinco Sentidos.
Yep, really, really good. Same thing. Jason, the gentleman who curates it, based out of Oaxaca, an incredible palette, and their stuff's so good. It's just so good. And you know, the money's going to a good source. You know what I mean? It's
So that's kind of the other thing I wanted to ask is, you know, you are take pride in and are teaching people about the ethically sourced, you know, mezcals out there. So define what that is for you. I mean, it sounds like they're taking care of their staff. They're not lying about what's in there. It's an honest product. So, you know, because there's so much out there and there's so much marketing and everybody's making a mezcal and every other celebrity is like, oh, mezcal's cool. Let's own a mezcal. You know, it's like, who's really doing the work? You know,
you don't want to get me started on that one.
A little bit.
I mean, for me, ethically produced mezcal, I think there's something. I'm just, imagine you're going down to Mexico, like everyone claims they are. A lot of time it's not. But imagine you're going down to Mexico, you find a person that has been making this beautiful spirit for generations in their backyard. If you were to approach them and all of a sudden go, great, I need you to make 10 times as much. And you have to keep in mind, these plants take a long time to grow.
Yeah.
8 to 12 years, you know, for Espadine, which is the most common varietal, but they get way wild agaves, way more extensive. Imagine going to that person and being like, okay, I need like a bajillion times more than you're used to making. So like, how are you going to cut corners? I'll help you cut corners. And also like, I'm buying so much that I want a discount. I want like all these, you know, there's all these going down there and trying to monetize it and try to make a business out of it. It just doesn't make sense. It's not portable. You know, it's like people, I mean, I say this as a total hypocrite, but you know, it's like, if you want to get drunk and take shots and all that stuff, like agave spirits aren't the most sustainable option for that. In my opinion, you know, like, you know, you said you grew up on Aguardiente. Great. Sugar cane is, you can grow a ton of it. You can grow a ton of it quickly. Yep. You can make it ethically. It's a very terroir driven spirit. It's beautiful. And, you know, if you drink the shit out of it, you're not gonna like run out as quickly as like basically the mezcal is blowing up. But you know, it's like when you look at a bottle of mezcal, like that's not a brand, it's a person. And sometimes it ends up scaling, and that's the whole thing is once you scale up something that small, you have to be really careful about how you do it, because it very quickly deteriorates what it should be at the base, which is like an example of terroir and a person handling that terroir and what they want to bring to you. So if you look at a bottle of mezcal and you don't see who makes it on it, it's a warning sign a lot of the time, you know. Brands like Del Maguey, you know, they're a big brand. Mm-hmm. They used to have who made their stuff on it, and now they don't. But and they have reasons for that, or maybe we can talk to them about it. But there's a lot of smaller brands that could be more boutique and could be more transparent, and they don't have that information on there. And I think that once you start looking at eliminating the backstory behind it, which is something that makes it beautiful, makes it unique, it actually makes it a distinguished, unique spirit. Mm-hmm. And you start hiding that, and you start making it more branding. And like at Gracias Madre, I don't carry any underproof mezcal. Like I carry basically 44-ish, roughly, percent and below, because that's what you would serve it at traditionally in Mexico. I don't carry 40% mezcal, you know, because that's an Americanized product that is designed to be an intro, which is fine, to the people of to ideally start enjoying mezcal under other aspects. But yeah, I just don't mess with that stuff. So it's I think you can at this point. Like I understand, you know, 6 years ago needing to be more or less choosy about what mezcals you bring in. But you don't have to do that anymore. There's so much good stuff on the market that you don't have to support people that you don't feel 100% behind. And I'm not saying that like, these people are doing a bad job just because it's 40%. I just don't need it. I don't need it. You know?
Yeah. Why settle for that? There's no point. I totally get what you're saying. It's like, it's been insane to see how Mezcal has blown up really and become so available just in the last decade, I guess. I'm trying to think, maybe even before that, 15 years or something, you know, it was something I saw occasionally here and there and nobody really knew about. And, you know, I felt like, why do I know about this? Oh, maybe because I grew up with people who had it in their homes, you know, growing up around so many Mexicans and stuff who had this shit from their families. And so I feel fortunate to have known that. And now everyone's like, yeah, this gal.
Right.
Well, yeah, but you're just putting it in a margarita. I actually like to sit home and sip it. You know?
Yeah, you know. And
which is cool. Do what you want.
Yeah, I mean, like when I went to De Leo for the first time, which is one of my favorite bars I've ever been to, it's down in Guadalajara. Mm-hmm. The gentleman who runs Mazonte, it's actually one of his, it's his cantina.
Okay.
So they don't mix with mezcal there. They don't. Like if you want a drink, you have it with rum or whiskey or tequila. Like they don't mix with mezcal. They're not, they'll talk to Pedro about it. And he's like, well, I'm not opposed to it. And he goes, I've had good mezcal cocktails. I just choose not to do it at my bar. It's like, and you know, that's like, but and, you know, here in America, like I'd say one of our only things we can actually claim to having contributed to like food and drink culture, like independently is cocktails. You know, like we cocktails. So it's how we have to, it's how we intro people to things. And I love cocktails. You know what I mean? There's no shame in it, but I think we can mix with respect. For sure.
So we need to talk about music as well. And so my first thought, I was like, what is the most metal of mezcals? Because I know you're a metal guy. But maybe we could go to the metal thing. Because have those worlds ever intertwined for you? Have metal and mezcal ever like have you been able... You did play a metal night for us. Or I'm sorry, you bartended a metal night for us at the Mermaid, I remember.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but I don't know if you've had any excuse to like bring your two loves together.
I did my first metal cocktail night at the Mermaid, which was tons of fun. I've done it. That was so popular. I ended up doing it two more times, once at Sunny's Hideaway, and then I did another one at Portland Cocktail Week at Boise.
Cool. Nice.
Which is really fun. I'm actually planning on doing more, but COVID.
So. Yeah, totally. We'll get back to the rock.
Yeah, so.
But you did used to play in a band, you were telling me. You were actually, and was it a metal band? Did you start with metal?
Yeah, so I was in a metal band, a touring metal band for most of my 20s.
Mm-hmm. What did you play, or did you sing?
I did vocals. Yeah, I did vocals in the metal band. We would all write the songs together, but live I would do vocals, and which is really fun. It was one of the best times of my life, for sure.
Do you have any recordings of that?
Oh yeah, we're on like Spotify and Apple Music.
Oh really? Okay, what was the name of the band?
Yeah. Mouth of the Serpent.
Mouth of the Serpent. Did you make a cocktail called Mouth of the Serpent?
No.
At Sunny's or something? You always Maybe have I great will. Names. You have great names for your trays.
Thank you. Yeah. For the middle night. I try to make the menus very thematic. Yeah. Mm.
So, okay. So it was Mouth of the Serpent. Got it. Because this, yeah, you know, yeah. I'm looking this up. I have to look this
up.
Please. Yeah. We'll get that $0.02 to you. Like, $0.02 streaming
you.
Earning,
that.
Right?
Yeah. Give me that 0.06 cents.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that for a long time. And then recently I made a little foray back into metal for fun. The card game Magic the Gathering did a reveal for their new card set, which is a Viking world called Kaldheim. And I got paid to curate a band. So we put together a band, wrote some songs, teamed up with some people I really, really enjoy and respect in the industry. And we wrote songs and we made a fictitious metal band that played on a fake talk show that revealed all the new cards, like kind of as the backing band.
That's amazing.
Which was it was really cool. So.
Is that something that someone could still watch if they wanted to?
Yeah. If you went on YouTube or on Twitch under Magic the Gathering Kaldheim, you were to type that in and be the first thing that pops up.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was very fun. It was a really fun, cool opportunity. Yeah, it was great.
I really love it. So what got you... Oh, no, go ahead.
No, please.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, what got you in, when did you, I mean, were you a kid like singing in your mirror at home and then you're like, I must be in a band.
Man,
what got you started?
I really wish. I wish I was.
I mean, who are you obsessed with when you were a kid?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was like a really young kid, Ozzy Osbourne has always been one of my favorites, mm-hmm. Like forever and for always. I've been obsessed with Ozzy since I was a kid, and it's ring true. Like riding in the car with my cousin, blasting, you know, Mr. Crowley and whatnot. Like for always. Adjacent things, like I don't know, when I was in like sixth grade, I got into like Papa Roach and all that, mm-hmm. and I liked to grow some music. Mr. Bungle, I was really big on.
Oh yeah, that's awesome.
Which was which is a great foray. But yeah, no, there's this one point I was hanging out with some kids that are a little older than me. I mean, we're kids, and we would drive around. I remember my friend Nick Stanley, we would drive around in his old beat up car with like the worst speaker system ever. And he had like the CD player put into the tape deck and do his thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we would go on high rides and just get super stoned. And he would pop on the most abrasive like black metal and death metal and just show me these things. And I remember like not liking a lot of it, but then liking just like really just treasuring this moment and just trying to like, and then, I started finding metal I really liked, and I just kept making myself listen to metal, and I would find a band, and all of a sudden, it would click. Like, okay, like, I like this kind of metal. I like this kind of metal. I like this kind of metal. And then all of a sudden, it was just like, I listen to metal all the time. Like, I just listen to so much metal. And by the time I was a junior in high school, like, I was fully obsessed. And I would drive out to San Francisco, and we'd, go out to the Pound and go to metal festivals. And I actually ditched school. My graduation was on 666, my senior graduation. And we ditched part of our graduation to go see Slayer play on 666, which is really fun. And
was that in the city?
I love the metal community. And
was that in the city that you went and got to see them? I'm guessing you were a Bay Area kid.
No, they played... Where did they play? It was like some big amphitheater, like in like Concord, or it was like the Palace or something. Yeah. Yeah, that was a big venue.
No, I lived in the Bay Area for 18 years. I was there through the 90s and some of the 2000s. So I'm trying to think, and I worked in radio in the Bay Area in the 90s. So I'm like, okay, what were some of the good metal fests that were coming up at that time?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I used to go to so many, but Yeah, it was great. You know,
well, what was one of the first, you were saying, like, you know, you're listening to metal in the car with your friend and it, like, snaps. What were some of those early, like, this band, you're like, wait, I think I actually like this band, and it's like some black metal. What were some of those bands? Oh, yeah. Do you remember? You got to remember.
Yeah, some of my good.
Some of your early favorites.
Yeah. One of my favorite death metal bands I still love is Gorguts. I love them. They're incredible. Black metal wise, bands like Leviathan, I really, really loved. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there was a bunch. I mean, it's hard to put my finger on. I remember in 10th grade, I got super, it was not cool to like at the time. Like, all my friends were listening to really underground black metal, and this was a little more poppy, but I loved the Black Dahlia Murder so much, and it was like a good kind of high energy foray into that. Mm-hmm. I still love the Black Dahlia Murder, and they've become a very respectable band, in my opinion, but back then it was more like metal. Back then it was like more metalcore, you know, it was all the older kids were like, oh, that's lame new stuff, and now they're cool. But yeah, I mean, there's so much good stuff, and like I'm also a big prog rock fan, so it was nice. Like it was just really cool, just like really technically proficient music. It was finding bands that paralleled it, you know. It's the same thing, we'd be listening to like Yes, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden we'd be popping on Gorguts and Suffocation, mm-hmm. and you know, stuff like that. It's just, yeah, I mean, I remember Suffocation hearing for the first time, because that was the first time I heard like guttural low vocals. I loved that.
Is that
my friends all listen to
is that what you do when you sing? Do you do the Cookie Monster stuff?
Like, yeah.
Okay, as someone who my only experience singing is like karaoke in the church choir, you know, when I was in it. Although, you know, people are kind enough to say when I sing along in the car, I don't sound bad. But anytime, I figure there has to be a technique to doing that voice. I have another friend who does that voice. What is his band right now? Oh my God, I can't believe I'm spacing on his band, but you've probably heard of them. But he does that voice too. And I was just like, how can you do that without hurting yourself? You know, how does you know, and he's like, well, after a while you kind of, you have a method. There's a way you do it so that it doesn't really like, you know, scar you.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it's tough. It's like, I mean, I would go.
How do you teach yourself to do that?
Trial and error. You know, I would look it up. And there's this woman, Melissa Cross. She has a DVD called The Zen of Screaming, mm-hmm. which is all about techniques about how to do that without hurting your throat.
Wow.
But basically it's a lot of it's in the diaphragm. Using your diaphragm, learning how to project correctly, learning your range to operate within. I mean, a lot of it would be like, I mean, a lot of it was just trial and error, you know, but you learn pretty quick when you're a kid on tour for a month and a half.
Yeah.
You have two nights off of shows, and you realize that if you blow out your throat, you're not going to have enough gas money to get to the next gig. You learn pretty quick, but you know, even no matter what, you know, after a 2 month long tour, when I would come back, it would just be like, I'm not going to talk for like a month.
Oh,
it was just like,
oh my God.
That's yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
How did you wind up in the vocalist role? You just didn't feel like learning an instrument or you're just that guy.
I play instruments.
What do you play?
I play, but, I'm not good at multitasking, but my friend's band, which was the one I ended up playing, their vocalist, I remember I just kept going, oh, I could do that better. I could do that better. And I was like, oh, you gotta let me be your vocalist. Let me be your vocalist. And then the vocalist quit, and I was like, all right. So they tried me out, and I was in. So I actually did it. Hilariously enough, I actually started doing metal vocals to make fun of my friends when I wasn't into metal yet, and they were. So I would do it, and I would like try to make fun of it. But they're like, "That's actually pretty good." I'm like, okay, cool. But it's pretty fun.
That's hilarious. Yeah. What instruments do you play?
Bass is my main instrument.
Oh my God,
my friend.
We just had the last person I interviewed also played bass, and then Ed Rudisell, who is a Shift Drink. Podcast.
Oh, okay.
He's Room, you know those guys, he's metal, mm-hmm. he's also bass player, and he's like, this is why we can never have a bartender band, because everyone's bass players.
That's so funny. Yeah, I play guitar too, and I'd like to say I play drums, just not enough. Sorry, 2 seconds, my iPad is telling me it's gonna die, so I'm gonna go plug it in.
Oh, okay, no problem.
I will remain here the whole time. Yeah,
it's the magic of the iPads, right? They're the magic of all of this stuff.
See here. All right, changing some venue.
Where is the cord? That's awesome. I remembered my friend's band name. It was Lightning Swords of Death.
Oh yeah, I love the band. I've seen it a ton of times.
Yeah, Farron Kirshner, the singer of that, someone I've known for years. And he's, but he, that band is gone and he's in another band now. And I can't remember what that one's called.
Yeah, they haven't put out a release in a while. But yeah, mm-hmm. Lenny Fair's a death man.
Yeah,
they're great.
Farron's
they have
great.
A good logo.
And then, yeah, well, he draws it. He does all that art. Farron's the artist.
Great.
That's what he does. Awesome. So if you ever want that metal art or something, I mean, he designs album covers for people and shit. That was his day job for a long time. He's been getting really into catering for years because he's also a great cook. He's also a great cook, which lends me to that connection between music and the kind of creative culinary world, because that's something I've definitely come across. And I don't know if that's something that you see, since you can make music and you're also creating cocktails, learning all this stuff. I mean, do you see that kind of that link there or anything?
Oh,
just
yeah.
The creativity.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. Maybe it's just like how I'm personally, I know a lot of musicians that play music now, or I'm sorry, musicians that are in the bar world or the food
or
world.
Or food world. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, when I got my job at Republic, Sean, who was a bit of a mentor to me, I consider him to be, I don't know if he's always like, I didn't teach you anything. I'm like, yes, you did.
Yeah.
You taught me everything.
Aww.
When he was interviewing me, I think part of what got me that job there was, he was like, so what do you do? And I was like, well, I've been in a band. I still am in a band. We were touring all the time and I got into the bar world and now I like making cocktails and I'm obsessed with cocktail culture and spirits culture. And he was like, I was in a touring band and all this stuff. And he like started showing me pictures of him with like really long hair and all this stuff like pretty recently. And we like identified over just kind of our story about slowly phasing over to the bar world and finding that creativity. And I mean, plus musicians love to drink, you know?
Yeah, like, I know.
Yeah.
So, and I know, and we already talked that you've done like metal themed booze nights as well.
Yeah.
And I always ask people, I'm like, have you ever had a chance to kind of like, you know, did you create drinks with names of songs, you know, that you did and all this, but you've done that.
Yeah.
And I still remember one of your Sunny's nights where was that the one where you served the drink with little trees?
I did that at all the metal ones. Yeah, I made that one was called Broken Sword, named after the Bathory song. It was really fun. I made these like little coasters with all these little trees on them.
Yeah.
And then the actual drink itself, I bought these small metal swords.
Yes.
And we put them in the top of the drink and we lit them on fire. I wanted the drink to look like a flaming sword in the woods.
Yeah, it was very Norwegian.
yeah, that was a fun one. That was an interesting pop-up because I'm not doing that on the next iteration, but all of the drinks I made, the challenge to myself was that they all had kind of gross ingredients in them.
I remember the camel milk one.
Yeah.
Clarified camel milk, and I was like, where on earth do you find camel milk? That's not something I ever thought about.
It's this ongoing joke because I had to buy it, of course, on the internet, like overnight it. And I still get text messages that are like, we're doing our end of the year sale on camel milk. 20% off. It's just pretty funny. But yeah, that particular pop-up actually, I bought holy water on the internet and I acidified it. So there was actually no citrus in any of those cocktails. It was all holy water from the River Jordan, blessed in the Vatican, that I bought. And I added citric and malic acid to it in order to create balance in the cocktail. So that was.
I had no idea you had done that. Dude, I went to Catholic school. There's this little part of me that's just like, I don't know what to think about. But I think I actually think it's awesome because once I was done with Catholic school, I was also done with Catholicism. But I mean, that's like, that's so crazy. I love that. Oh my God. What a heathen.
I'd say the most offensive part was I did a burnt Bible orgeat, I called it. It was pretty funny.
Oh my God, that is pretty metal.
I literally just burnt Bibles and then mixed it with water, sugar, orange flour, and rose water, and I made it into a syrup.
It was actually paper.
It was
like,
burnt
Bibles. It was a burnt Bible.
Yeah.
Whoa. Oh my God.
Yeah. I'll send you some videos of me making it.
Oh my
funny.
God. That is so crazy.
I had no idea. Like,
I feel like I'm sure I had some of that. I don't remember.
Yeah, that was in the Flaming Sword one.
Oh my God. That is so insane. I fucking love it. I
It was pretty fun.
Love it. So, and this stuff, see, I think, you know, I think someone without that kind of history of metal background couldn't come up with that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I just wanted to be like offensive and ridiculous.
Well, there's an irreverence to it.
Yeah.
It's still fun. It's very irreverent and it's very metal. And, you know, there's all that there. Oh my God, that is so crazy.
Yeah. It was fun. The next one I'm doing isn't quite the same.
Mm-hmm.
Some people in the cocktail community, I don't think really got, everyone loved it except for some of my friends that were like, well, why would you put ingredients in something that don't taste good? I was like, well, that's the fun. It's like a challenge. It's a concept pop-up. It's not really a normal cocktail pop-up. But
you made it taste good.
Yeah, it was fun. So the next one I'm doing, I've been R&Ding for a while. Mm-hmm. It's on the back burner. It's more of a little bit more, less literal metal, because if you go on my Instagram, I have all the garnishes. They're always like super metal. I'm doing that, but I'm applying that concept of metal brutality and themes, but I'm applying it more to like a tiki kind of a vibe on the next one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the father of, he created the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey, before he created, was the founder of the Church of Satan, he actually was an organ player for a carnival. So he has a whole album, he has a record out of his organ music, and it's called Satan Takes a Holiday.
Yes, that I'm familiar with, because we had it at my radio station. Again, Bay Area radio station, nonprofit. Sure. It was a non-commercial radio station, so we had that.
that's great. That's
awesome. You can't be in San Francisco and not know about Anton LaVey.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the biggest Church of Satan is there. You know? So my next whole metal pop-up I'm working on that I had pretty much nailed down that I'll do once the world reopens is also called Satan Takes a Holiday.
Nice.
But it is more themed about what if Satan took a holiday. So it's like Satan on vacation, kind of.
Well, a question I can have for you related to that kind of is, you know, I always like to ask for pairings. I always say to people, what are you listening to while you're drinking this? And it seems like you've actually had life experience with that because, you know, you've done DJ metal DJ nights while you're making cocktails and all of that. But maybe you can just recommend, you know, to our people. Maybe there's a cocktail someone can make at home during this COVID time where we're all locked away and becoming home bartenders. Or maybe it's just something to sip on. And what should they listen to get the full Max Rees experience?
Oh, that's so funny. You know what's hilarious is my ex-girlfriend used to always make fun of me because we had this insanely gorgeous Clawfoot bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
And we're coming off a double and all this stuff. And I would just walk in and just look like, I'm just like, I just need to chill out. I'm dead. I just worked a double. And even though this isn't a cocktail, and she would laugh at me because like my favorite thing to do ever was I would just put on like Wolves in the Throne Room or some like really beautiful, like Norwegian.
Like an orchestral metal kind of thing.
This is just like, it's sort of black metal, but it's got more of like a beautiful kind of vibe to like nature worship black metal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just pour myself a giant glass of mezcal, run a bath, and just roll a huge joint. And I would just sit in the bathtub and I would just like smoke weed and drink mezcal and just like vibe out.
See, and that is perfect. Perfect.
It was so much fun. I love it.
And we all need that right now, especially, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody, anything they can use to relax, dude.
Yeah, exactly. What's funny is that a lot of my metalhead friends, they're not really that into, I mean, people like are receptive to cocktails, but a lot of the time, like metal musicians, they can't really afford to like drink a bunch of fancy stuff too, you know? So it's like, it was really funny when I was on tour because I was already working in restaurants. And I was kind of a bougie little bastard, but it was like really funny because, you know, we would just drink a bunch of beer and all that. But I remember I was touring with my friend's band Apparitions and Griffin, the singer who RIP, he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was great because it was really funny because he would just drink like the gnarly, like flavored vodkas and the handle and all that. And I remember we passed through Napa, which is my hometown, and my friend Ian, we had a still that he would always like pop like failed batches of beer we'd make or wine in there, but he made really good high gravity grappa and brandy, but he gave us this bottle of, he went to our show in Oakland, we played at like the old East Bay Rats Clubhouse. I don't remember what it was called.
I used to know. I used to bartend, or not bartend, I used to DJ at a bar where they were our door guys. So I remember going to parties there, but I can't remember what it was called either.
There you go. Perfect. Yeah. But yeah, we went there and he brought me this giant bottle of like, you know, 93% grappa and brandy that we made. And I went on the tour with all these metal guys. And it was this fun intersection point where all of them were like so into the fact that I had this insanely high alcohol. But at the same time, it's like, this is like pretty hilarious bartender nerdy shit where I'm like, oh yeah, we made grappa. Like, you know, but it was so funny watching all these metalheads just get trashed on grappa. And like, or yeah.
You're like, you know what it is? It's booze. It works. Here you go.
Oh yeah. It was the best. My favorite was my buddy Griffin, because he would get drunk normally at the show, and then at some point every night, I remember he would go, "Hey Max, like we have to try that grappa," and I'd be like, "Dude, you've had it the past 3 nights. Like, you just forgot. Blasting out your brains with my super grappa." Yeah.
Well, I think that's probably a good point to like wrap things up and everything. You can let people know where they can find you. You know, your Instagram stuff, because I mean, honestly, your Instagram is both hilarious and educational, so I am a fan. You know, you're slowly taking over the booze meme world with your creations.
I'm like, I've been in a drought the past couple of weeks.
Rough couple of weeks here in LA. Yeah. So yeah,
that's okay.
We're just trying to survive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you can find me online at my Instagram handle is Beer Ghost, beer like the beverage, ghost like the spooky thing. yeah, which was my nickname for a hangover in high school. I'd say I'd be haunted by a beer ghost.
Oh, I like
that.
That's
how that came about. Yeah,
very like, good.
The ghost of beer. yeah, you can find me there. You can come visit me at Gracias Madre in West Hollywood whenever we're open again, which should hopefully be the beginning of February.
And currently you guys are doing to go for anyone who is locally based.
We've actually shut down for the month.
Okay. Okay.
But we'll be back open soon. And I can't say exactly what, but if you keep an eye on my Instagram, I will have a fun cocktail announcement or two popping up here pretty soon.
All right, cool. All right.
Yes. Cool. So you will be able to enjoy my cocktails in some facet very soon.
Very cool. Very soon. So at Beer Ghost on Instagram, best way to go. So, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, don't hang up, but thank you so much. I'm going to turn off the tape recorder, but I had something else I wanted to tell you. Thank you so much for doing this, though. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure that we've taught listeners something today. And there you go. Follow Max at Beer Ghost on Instagram so that you can stay up to date on metal, mezcal, Magic the Gathering, and miscellaneous mayhem. I had so much fun saying that. And thank you so much to Max for being on the podcast. I've been wanting to interview him for a while because he's so nice and really fun. Couldn't you tell? You could totally tell. So thanks for tuning in, and remember to check out his super hardcore, maybe that's not the word for it, actually, you'll have to go listen to it for yourself, but we do have a Spotify playlist over on the She Be Mo Spotify page for you to listen to that Max has created for us. And did you think we were going to listen to his band? Because of course we're going to listen to his band. So now let me play for you Mouth of the Serpent. The song is called Blood Rite.
Sorry.
Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com and also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thank you for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guest, or if you want to connect with me, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. While you're there, give the show a rating and a review. It really helps to get the word out. If you want to hear the playlists our guests have curated, search She Be Mo on Spotify, S-H-E-B-M-O. Find pictures of the interviewees and the cool stuff they create on the Music and Booze with Mo Instagram account. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.